Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, this is a special bonus edition podcast. Greg, in January 2020, just a little more than a year ago, we did, I think, one of my favorite interviews ever. I bet you feel the same way.
Oh, yeah. There was joy in the air. Talking to Mary Wilson was such a delight. I mean, she makes everybody feel good. I bet you that's the way she, you know, did all these amazing things in this decades-long career. Co-founding member of the Supremes. The one constant in that band over the decades.
Fashion icon. Yeah,
absolutely. Was a businesswoman, an author, a brilliant singer who understood the importance of harmony vocals in the group's overall sound. You know, remained perhaps unfairly a bit in the background, but, you know, anybody who worked with Mary Wilson never forgot her.
Mary Wilson died at the age of 76 on February 9, and so we will revisit in this special podcast our wonderful chat with her in January of 2020. Enjoy.
We sat down with Mary, who was a consistent part of the Supremes from its founding until the group's dissolution in 1977. She's also a prolific author. Her latest book, Supreme Glamour, highlights the group's origin story, as well as those iconic costumes. When you think of the Supremes, you think of the songs, but man, those outfits they wore on the Ed Sullivan Show and, you know, Soul Train, amazing. And that is where Jim started our conversation, asking Mary about how their Detroit upbringing impacted their burgeoning fashion sense from a very young age.
A lot of people are not aware because they had this idea about black people not being, you know, fashion type people. But we were in Detroit, Michigan, honey, people dressed up. I mean, the black folks were dressed. All right. And it was so great because, yes, in church is where you really saw, because we didn't have a lot of clubs and things like that. But you really saw how women would come there with their huge hats on, you know, and beautiful high heel shoes and their dresses. So Florence, Diane and I and Betty, our fourth member, all kind of grew up in that environment of our parents, our aunts, and not uncles, but our aunts, you know, and our moms, and all the females were always really dressed well. Plus, they admired some of the black singers and performers who were very big in our black community, maybe not around the world so much. The Lena Horns, you know, Dorothy Dandridge, and we had so many beautiful black females. So we had our eye on those type of women because our parents did. Our, you know, our moms, they just love and idolize these women. So we grew up with that.
Stormy weather since my man and I ain't together.
Raining all
Well, Mary, you had also mentioned that you and Diana Ross, your childhood friend, would make a lot of the outfits early on, right? I mean, how did that start? Was that because your moms taught you how to do that, or how did you learn that skill?
Well, we didn't have all the Targets and all the stores, you know, that they have now out there where you can go and buy, you know, things. No, we really had to. My mom was a domestic worker back in the day, and she would bring home sometimes some of the leftovers or handovers from the family that she worked at, the white family she worked in. So, yeah, we learned how to sew. My mom had a little sewing machine, and Diane took sewing in her. She went to a more college preparatory school, and she really had a better idea of sewing than I did. I just learned how to sew, but Diane really learned well. And we would sit there and make some of our short little dresses. We did very early on. I think we really only made one or two, actually.
One of the things that jumped out about the book, Supreme Glamour, that your third book, Mary, is that you talked about the idea that you always wanted to be on that stage, that was the thing that really drew you to it. It wasn't so much about any one particular aspect of it. It was more just being in front of an audience, right? I mean, where did that come from?
Okay, so I let me explain that to you, because early on, it wasn't that I wanted to be a performer, because, you know, we're talking about 19 in the 50s. So black people really were not trying to become stars and things like that back in those days. You know, people were struggling just to be human beings and accepted as a bona fide American citizen. I would wake up singing, and like Sammy Davis used to say, he said he'd open up the refrigerator and start, you know, singing. I was that kind of person. I thought everybody in the world woke up singing. Because I'm this very kind of happy person. And it wasn't until I really, rock and roll became very popular back in the early 50s, and I started listening to the music. And then in school, elementary school, we had a contest one year, and I had just seen Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, and they were singing, "Why Do Birds Sing So Gay?" And anyway, that one, and I'm not a juvenile delinquent, so I went on the show, and I just started pantomiming to their records, and the crowd was saying, "Go Mary, go Mary," and I was like, "Whoa, this feels really good." Now, I'm only 11 or 12 years old, and on the same show was Florence Ballard. I didn't really know Flo at the time. She just lived in the same project complex as we. And she was singing Ave Maria. Okay, now we're 11 years old children, you know, young people. And I just admired her voice. I was like, my God, she had such a beautiful voice. And we just started talking. And that's how we actually got together with in this little group, because her sister was dating one of the primes, and they asked Florence if she wanted to sing in this group, and she said, "Yeah, my new friend Mary," and then that's how we met Diane, and you know, we kind of started that way. But even then, I didn't want to become a singer. It wasn't until we put the group together, we started just doing little things around the city, just having fun. We were just having fun. Then we were on shows with other stars who were recording, and we got the idea, well, wow, maybe we should think about recording. So this is when the idea of me wanting to be, you know, on stage and really become a singer. And after that, we auditioned at Motown. Mr. Berry Gordy turned us down.
Yeah, I love that story. So self-empowered, self-assured, rather cocky young women.
Yeah, we were.
You know, you thought Berry Gordy ought to be listening to you, and he like sends you guys packing, says, "Come back when you're done with high school."
Yes, he did. He did. And we were really not happy about this. Okay. We were still about 15 years old. And so I remember walking out the door, Florence said, "You can't be that great if they don't know how good we are."
Yeah, I love that.
I mean, because we really, actually, when I look back on it now, 50-some years later, you know, I say we really were. And you said the word cocky. I've never used that one. But anyway, I think we really were. And eventually, we decided to stay there at Motown every day. We'd hang outside the doors, and pretty soon someone came out and said, "We need some hand clappers." We said, "We'll do it." And that's how we got into the doors of Motown. Yeah. And that's how we got in. And it was really at that point, I can finally say that, yeah, I really knew that that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So that's when the bug really got me.
No, you pretty little thing. I really want to be your man.
So you signed to Motown in 61. You already had a sense of self, Mary. It sounded like you and the fellow ladies were very self-assured in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But it took a long time. By
no
music
hit.
Biz terms,
no
the No-Hit
Supremes.
Supremes became...
I made that up.
That was you, right.
Yeah.
I did. And I tell you why. Because, as you mentioned, was that Greg who said that? Okay. As you mentioned, we started recording all these little records, and they were by Smokey Robinson. Hey. And we really sounded, we thought, really good, and we were great with harmonies. However, we recorded like, I don't know, 6-7 songs that still had not become hit records. And at the time, you know, everyone at Motown, it was Mary Wells, they were getting hit records and we were not. So we said, listen, you know, we really need a hit. And I remember I thought that maybe people were laughing behind our backs because, you know, we thought we were so good and we still didn't have a hit record and everyone was leaving us behind. So that's when I coined the phrase No Hit Supremes, because I knew they were laughing at us behind our backs and saying the Supremes think they're so cute, but they don't have a hit record.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So that's when Mr. Berry Gordy finally said, I'm going to put you girls with one of my best writing teams and producing teams, Holland Dozier Holland, who most of us know as Brian and Eddie Holland and Lamont Dozier. Now, let me tell you this story. When we were trying to see what to record, we told Eddie, we said, listen, we got to have a hit record, because if we don't, then our parents are going to make us go to college because they want us to get an education.
Yeah, all right.
So we got the hit record. We didn't have to go to college. And that's when the hits started coming. And it was then in 1963 and 1964, we had our first number one million selling records of 5 consecutives that were, you know, all together to come, which had not been done by anyone, not the Beatles, not Elvis, not anybody who was recording. So we finally had the last laugh, you know, the No Hit Supremes.
The first big song that Holland Dozier Holland wrote for you, Where Did Our Love Go? You tell an interesting story in the book about how you weren't particularly fond of that song initially when you got it presented to you, right?
I know. Because, I mean, it's a good song, obviously, because it was a million seller, right? And people loved it. But we would sing standard material, songs like The Four Freshmen, and you know, we really were great at harmony. And also, then all the artists at Motown were more R&B. Well, it ended up that we weren't as R&B as we wanted to be. So we wanted a record that had that more R&B kind of sound. Sort of like Martha and the Vandellas, you know, Dancing in the Street, or the Barbalettes.
More
up-tempo. Please, Mr. Postman.
Yeah.
And we were kind of square. So our music was square, we thought. And so this record, Where Did Our Love Go, for us seemed just too square. It wasn't R&B. It wasn't soulful like we wanted it to be. So that's why we didn't like it. And so we begged them. And so Eddie Holland said, Mary, trust me, this song is going to be a hit record. Well, hey, he was right. So ever since then, every time I see him, I have to give him a big hug and say, thank you, Eddie.
he was right. Well, and there's that longstanding fallacy out there that the Supremes got Where Did Our Love Go? Only after the Marvelettes turned it down. Not true, says Mary Wilson.
And it's not true. It's not true. And even I believed it for a while because, you know, I didn't know who they had given a song to. But I when I interviewed people for all of my books, I interviewed Eddie Holland and asked him that question, did you really give this song to, Where Did Our Love Go, to the Marvelettes? And he said, no, Mary, we wrote that song for the Supremes. Yeah. So I got the real story.
There you go. Well, we're going to take Mary Wilson's word on that. You know, there's a great story you've told, this notion of, as such young women becoming celebrities, it's a weird thing. And at first, the thing that really hit you is that Hudson's, the famous Detroit department store, would stay open. And this is a place where Diana Ross had worked. They're like, you know, the run of the department store is turned over to you and Flo and Diana.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, as I mentioned early on, it was a time when Black people weren't that, you know, popular, let's say. And we would go to stores, shopping stores, and people would follow you around because you were Black and they think maybe you were going to steal something. You know, now that we became famous and whatever, they would leave some of the stores open. You could tell that America was changing, actually.
And I'm going to tell you about equal opportunity. There was a time when the world was fickle and it may have been hard to succeed. But times have changed now and school and training is all you really need. It doesn't
was changing, and we were changing as Black people in terms of the education. See, the education was so important, and our parents would always tell us, make sure you get the education. But I want you to know, I moved to New York back in, I think it was the mid-90s, and I went back and I got my associate's degree from NYU in New York City.
Well, speaking of school, Mary, it sounded like Motown was in many ways like your upper level education at the time. You went mm-hmm. back to college later, but as a young woman, Motown almost like helped that transition from that young, cocky girl group to the women who went and represented the world in these glamorous gowns. I think there's a lot of controversy about that, you know, how controlling Motown was over its act with the image and the choreography and the stage act. How did that play out for you?
I'm happy you asked that, but can I actually maybe change a word or two in there? Motown wasn't controlling. They actually, and if you look at like the Hollywood system, how they, you know, they groomed their talent, Motown was more of that type of thing. And that's what we wanted that. We wanted that because that's what we had in our homes. Our moms and our dads would teach us those kind of things. So now when we were singing, you know, we go into Motown Records, they also had the same type of values as we had. Mr. Berry Gordy's mom and father were one of the Black in the Black community who we would call kind of bougie because they they had a store, you know, and their daughters went to modeling school. And you had mentioned Maxine Powell, who actually owned the modeling school. Mm-hmm. Now she, at that point, she came to Motown and she started grooming us. And there was in a department called Artist Development. Also, there was Charlie Atkins, who was our choreographer. And people ask about Dancing with the Stars. And, oh, was that hard? It's like, no, we were doing that back at Motown. That's what Charlie Atkins was teaching us. You know, he really was. And if you look at any of those old, and we were on Ed Sullivan's show 16 times, if you look at any of those old clips, you'll see we were doing so many type of dances. Mm-hmm. We were singing the stanzas that we started before we were even at Motown. So, you know, those were the kind of things you mentioned. I'm glad you said that, that Motown was, it was like going to college. Mm-hmm. And look at all the people, the shoulders we rubbed shoulders with people, great, talented people. Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, you know, all these great artists, and they were all talented. It was like being at a musical Disneyland, you know, Motown was. And being rubbing shoulders and learning from these great, gifted people, it was college. It was a musical college.
And I'm gonna use every trick in the book. I'll try my best to get you hooked. Hey, baby.
Take me, I'm yours.
Mary, some of the best photos in Supreme Glamour are mm-hmm. those candid shots mm-hmm. of you and your bandmates, and sometimes mm-hmm. Maxine Powell, of the famous grooming school. You know, in Japan, in the UK, in London, to what extent did it, and when did it dawn on the group that we are not only celebrities now, Hudson stays mm-hmm. open for us, but we are ambassadors. We are ambassadors mm-hmm. of the African American community in the mm-hmm. United States, of the civil rights movement to the world. Did that hit you? Did the importance of that hit you?
You know, it's amazing. Everyone asked that question. Of course it did. And I say, of course, like that because, you know, and I hate to keep going back to that racial thing, but because black people were not really considered smart or any of those kind of things. So when we became famous and popular around the world, we knew that we had accomplished something that our parents had prepared us for, what Motown had prepared us for, you know, what we had dreamed about ourselves.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Coming up, more with Mary Wilson.
That's after a break on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. By 1968, the Supremes had racked up 12 number one hit singles. But after years of tension within the group, lead singer Diana Ross, of course, left to embark on a successful solo career. The Supremes, though, continued well into the 70s with a revolving membership with one constant, Mary Wilson. Greg asked Mary about that period in the group's history.
Well, I have to give a shout out to post-Diana Ross Supremes, which was, Mary, that was kind of, I think you were the reason that group kept going.
Oh, it was,
trust me. Had an enormous amount of success, perhaps underrated because the first incarnation of the group was such a huge hit. Mm-hmm. But I love when you got a chance to sing out front, Boy Joy.
That was a Smokey Robinson song, yes, yes.
Tell me about that.
I don't know how he gave it to me. I guess it just suited my voice. Because I do have a kind of, my voice is not as versatile as Diane's and a lot of people. I mean, I have a voice that I can sing certain things and sing them well. But if you put me out in some place, I can't. Smokey, you know, produced for Mary Wells. And a lot of her songs, for me, are songs that I could sing as well. So I think that perhaps when he was writing that song, he probably said, well, oh, here's one. Mary can do this. So I think it was that thing. I was very happy that he gave me that because it was my first real solo, mm-hmm. So which was really cool. In the group, I should say, yes.
Yeah,
thank
that's an
you.
Awesome moment. Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that you mentioned the 70s Supremes and versus the 60s, because the 60s, we made the hits. In the 70s, it was a new group, and we had hits too. Gene Terrell brought a wonderful sort of experience to us for the 70s. But after that, you know, we just didn't get the support from Motown and or the other sort of hit records that we needed. I should have quit earlier, but that wouldn't be fair to say about the other singers who came in late, because they were wonderful too. See what you're
Mary, I'm curious about your work that the Supremes recorded with Stevie Wonder back in 1973. Some of that music still remains unreleased.
Well, Stevie Wonder, you know what? Let me tell you, Stevie did the greatest song recording for us, which was called Bad Weather. I think I'm going to run into Bad Weather. Let's take Gene Terrell sang this song because this was after Diane had left the group, and Barry had brought Gene Terrell in, and that's when I decided to keep the group together, because after hearing Gene Terrell, I'm like, yes, she can do it. Mm-hmm. And we never finished that album. We only did the Bad Weather. I think they may be going to re-release a couple of those songs, but there were only a few. We didn't do a complete album. So those were your two albums.
How would history have been different if you did a full album in 73 with Stevie Wonder? How do you think?
Well, you know, I think it would have been great, because Bad Weather was a fabulous record. But at the time, we weren't really getting a lot of promotion, and the group was changing, members were leaving, and things like that. So that record didn't get a fair play on the radio. But you know what? It was at the time when I really realized it was time for me to end the group. So just shortly after that, of course, after Gene and Linda left, then we had Sherry Payne, who's Freda Payne's sister. She's an excellent singer. And Suzette Green. Now, they were the last Supremes. And that's what I just decided at that point. You know what? I cannot have another, you know, in and out, in and out. You got to know when to quit.
Your image, and I think not just the songs, but as you bring up in the book, the look, the image, the choreography, you know, it's transcended generations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that it's almost like you're a, you know, people could be dressing up as a Supreme, and mm-hmm. that would be a great costume, you know, like, oh, I know instantly what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously
mm-hmm.
you inspired so much art. I mean, Dreamgirls, you know?
Yes.
Where do you stand on that, Mary?
Well, yeah, in my shows, I have to say that I'm a little comical about it, and I treat it very lightly when it really is not. But what I say is that I know you guys have seen this movie and this play, you know, about the group that's supposedly about the Supremes. Well, I'm here to tell you that it's not true because I did not get paid. But I still think it was a beautiful project. I think it's a beautiful play. I love the play. I've seen it many times. Shirley Ralph and I are great friends. Mm. But still, I can't even write my own movie because people say, oh, we always saw the Supremes movie, Dreamgirls.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fair. But that's where we are.
I need love.
The legacy of what those the girls from the projects, as you said, mm-hmm. in Detroit mm-hmm. did and accomplished. You know, you go back and look at 15-year-old you. What would you have done differently, if anything, over the course of that career?
You know, after signing the Motown contract and, you know, those kind of things, when business really began to take over our thing, I can say that I probably should have got a lawyer. I think that's what I would have done differently. But in terms of for us, the three of us, I love Flo, I love Diane, love Betty, and Barbara, who replaced Betty.
So it was more the business side of it.
All the business
you would
side.
Wish you'd had somebody whispering in your ear back then saying maybe this is something you need to pay more attention to.
No, I don't want them whispering in my ear. I want a lawyer saying, Mary, this is not right.
A bulldog.
Right.
And before we end, I do want to say, because the book is about the Supreme glamour, the gowns we wore on Ed Sullivan's show, mm-hmm. Shindig, Hullabaloo, all those wonderful shows. And so the gowns are very prominent in the book. And my gown exhibit, Supreme gowns travel. They travel around the world, actually.
Mm-hmm. Mary, it's a dumb question, but the extraordinary photos that take up the center of the book,
yes.
Of just so many of those extraordinary outfits. Where do you keep them when they're not touring as part of the exhibit? You're like, how many warehouses do you have?
Look, honey, I need a rich husband to pay for them. I have storage units, yes.
Yeah.
And so
I'm sure it's got to be climate controlled, right? Because otherwise those beads are falling off, the fur is, you know.
Yeah, it's true, but I thank God that many of them have survived, and they look fabulous. We had photos taken of each of the gowns up close. You can almost touch the beading that was there because our Queen Mother gowns that we wore for the Queen Mother and Prince Charles and Princess Margaret and at our command performance in 1968. Those gowns weigh 30 pounds. They're beads, they're sequins, they're pearls. They're all kinds of things on it, but they're very heavy.
In the chaos of traveling and touring and wardrobe managers and road managers, there have been gowns that got out of your possession that fans have gone out, tracked down, purchase. You know, a woman from England buying it in France. Somebody else finding it on eBay. And they want to bring them back to you.
Yes. And there's a guy, Daniel, who called me one day. He says, Mary, guess what? I think your gowns are up on eBay. I'm like, buy it, buy it, buy it. Mm. And he did, you know, and then returned it to me. It was so sweet. But also, one last thing about what's in the book in terms of I'm very proud of is that I was able to speak with a lot of people who actually not just designed the gowns, but people who actually made them, who sewed every single bead on it. A lot of them have deceased now, but a couple are still alive, and I've spoken with them, and it's just such a pleasure to know these artisans because we're not keeping people who used to do all of that wonderful work. I mean, even people who style our hair, you know, the hair pieces, they call them wigs, but I call them hair pieces, they don't do that anymore. So I'm very happy that I was actually able to, really interview a lot of those people who worked on the gowns.
Yeah. I want, to know, Mary Wilson, what is one of your favorite Supreme songs? We know about the string of hits that numbered more than the Beatles, and maybe it's one of those, but I want to know which song is the one that gets you every time and why.
First of all, you're a guy. I'm a girl.
Yes.
I'm actually a mom, and I'm also a grandma and a great-grandma. You never tell which one is your favorite.
All right. Let me rephrase. Which is the one that makes you tear up when you hear it?
Many of our songs have lasted, and when I sing them now, because I didn't sing the lead before, so I wasn't really into the lyric as much. And the one I enjoy singing now so much is Reflections, because it's so true. I mean, every word is something I could say right now in terms of my own life and my experience.
Through the mirror of my mind, through these tears that I'm crying, reflects the hurt I can't control. Cause although you're gone, I keep holding on to the happy time, when you were mine. As I peer through the window of lost time.
So to answer your question, and not to be catty, I'll say Reflections. But it's not my
favorite. That's a beautiful thought. That's a beautiful thought. Yeah. So here you are at this point in life, with so many accomplishments, and the reflections are rich.
Yeah. I'm 75 and a half, and I say that because that's why it means so much to me, because I look at how things used to be, and I look at the people I'm losing in my life. We just lost recently the beautiful Diane Carroll. She and I were very dear friends. Mm-hmm. Nancy Wilson, she and I were very dear friends. Mm-hmm. And the world has lost two beautiful black women who really helped to carve the way we think about music and everything.
That is so true. We have been talking to the legendary Mary Wilson of Motown fame, author. And Dancing with the Stars star.
She was robbed. Sean Spicer, man. He was robbed.
Mary, I'm tell
saying
Sean
that.
You
Mary's
said
not.
That.
Mary's the nicest person we've ever interviewed. Doesn't say anything bad about anybody, but I'm saying that. But
such an honor to talk to you, Mary Wilson. Thank you
guys,
so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
That was me and Mr. Cott talking to the great Mary Wilson, feeling like every sentence she gave us was a hug, a ray of sunshine in cold January 2020 when we were recording at WBEZ. Mary Wilson, best known for the Supremes, but a life well-lived with many other accomplishments, dead at the age of 76.